Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you had a wonderful Memorial Day weekend, an opportunity to pay tribute to those who lost their lives in service to the country, as well as to enjoy some recreation, hopefully safely. If you got out to do some hiking or out to the beach to exercise or even going for a drive somewhere not too far away. A little bit later, we're going to open up the phones for you to share what you saw about what Southern California was like, from the mountains through the deserts to the ocean, for you to share what you observed. We're also going to talk about the new protocols that have been released by the state of California for the reopening of houses of worship, with limits on the size of those congregations, number of people that can come back to the synagogue, to the church, to the mosque. And we'll hear from faith leaders about their thoughts on bringing congregants back into houses of worship as soon as this weekend. But we begin with our daily update on COVID-19. Joining us once more from UCLA, a professor of medicine and public health, Dr. David Eisenman, who directs UCLA Center for Public Health and Disasters. He's also associate natural scientist at the RAND Corporation. Dr. Eisenman, welcome back. I hope you had a very nice weekend. Did you get an extra day?
I did, and it was lovely. It was great to be outdoors. Thank you for asking.
So we're glad to hear that. Hopefully we're all a little bit more refreshed. I wanted to start, first of all, with that NPR story that we just heard about what they said is the 10th of the clinical trials of a vaccine to go to the human safety testing, this one in Australia. Your thoughts about the number that we now have at this point?
Yeah, well, it's really good news. We are seeing, you know, we have over 100 vaccines that have been that are being developed across the world. We are having out of those over 100, over a dozen now, I think, are now in clinical trials, or about a dozen are in clinical trials. They'll start with the first phase, which is to look at safety. Last week we saw that one of them that was done by Mode RNA, also called Moderna, was safe in a cohort of 30 patients who were given it. Once they go from phase one to safety, they're then given to patients or volunteers to see if they have any increase in immunity as measured by increases in antibodies. So this is all very good. You know, I think that there is some optimism that a vaccine may be available by early 2021. There's still a long way between even developing a vaccine that's effective and, of course, producing enough for everybody to get them. But so far, things are on the right track.
And the scope of the endeavor is extraordinary. We've never had this number of clinical vaccines trials going at one time, have we?
No, it's really amazing. As we talked about before, this is kind of like a Manhattan Project for vaccines. And it's really a global Manhattan Project, as I said, because so many countries are working on this. The scientific community has been really great in sharing data among labs so that they can move forward faster on vaccine development and the science. And at the same time, the companies are starting to think about the back end of this, which is how to ramp up production if they have a successful one. It's an amazing effort all around.
Wanted to ask you about a very small scale study of pregnant women. And I just want to caution, if you're pregnant and you're listening, I don't want you to get upset or be worried about what we're going to talk about. It's 12 women and the babies all came out healthy and to size as we understand. However, it did appear that for mothers who had COVID-19, that there was an effect on the placenta. And Dr. Eisenman, I wonder if you can speak to that. There is a lot of redundancy in the placenta, isn't there?
Yes, right. So, I think you started off with the right introduction to this, which is that all the babies were born healthy and normal and beautiful, had Apgar scores, if anyone knows what that is, 9 out of 10, which is really excellent. So this was a very small study. It was, I think, 16 women who had COVID-19, and their placentas after they were born were compared to 16 women who did not have COVID-19. And they found evidence in the anatomy of the placenta that there was low blood flow in certain sections, including some clots. As I said, while they found these changes in the placenta, the babies were all very healthy. And this is because the placenta has a tremendous amount of redundancy, as you said. While its job is to, its job is important. It delivers oxygen and nutrients from the mother to the child. And so it's really an incredibly well-developed organ. It has a lot of redundancy that way. And we saw that with these babies being very healthy. And in fact, almost all studies that are in, systematic studies of pregnant women, have really found no effect on the birth of on the child itself from COVID-19. So at this point, what should pregnant women do? They should, they can talk about the results with their doctor. This probably will not change practice very much. It's a very small study, and it really is about raising the issue to look for it more, but not to change practice yet, probably.
And what do you think could be learned from this? Is there something, and perhaps not just applicable to the virus's effect during pregnancy, but beyond that, to understanding how it works in the body?
Yes, there is this common thread that's appearing among COVID-19 cases, which is a tendency towards clots and to effects on blood flow. We see that in sick adults, and that is part of the syndrome this rare syndrome that children get of this inflammatory illness after COVID-19. So it's on par with that effect on the vasculature, the arterioles, and the effect on clots. So in that sense, it's consistent.
And Dr. Eisenman, is this something that we have seen with other coronaviruses or other infectious diseases where you do have this higher risk of blood clots? It appears the vascular system is affected by it.
Well, I'm not an expert in infectious diseases of all the sorts, but my understanding is that this has not been seen in other coronaviruses. So, the other coronaviruses, three of them cause the common cold. And of course, we don't have any problem with blood clots when we get the common cold from a coronavirus. One of the other ones is SARS. I don't believe SARS caused this. I'm not sure about the last one called MERS. It's Mideastern respiratory syndrome, and it's a really pretty rare syndrome that I've never had any connection to.
We're talking with UCLA's Dr. David Eisenman, Public Health Authority Professor of Medicine at UCLA, and he directs the university's Center for Public Health and Disasters. I welcome your calls with your questions about the latest on COVID-19. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We are generally seeing a decrease in the number of hospitalizations and cases of COVID-19. So sort of the national takeaway is generally positive. Brazil, of course, is being inundated with the coronavirus. But if this continues, Dr. Eisenman, what then would be your next concern? When would we see a possible rebound of COVID-19?
Well, we have right now places where COVID-19 is decreasing, such as New York and New Jersey. We have places like California where it's decreasing, and even in Los Angeles, we've seen now a decrease in the three-day average of hospitalized cases that was just reported, down by 15%, and also a decrease in the average number of deaths over a week, down by 3%. So that's all good news. We, on the other hand, are seeing states where it's increasing number of cases: Alabama, Georgia, Florida, North Carolina. So we are, and not surprisingly, a lot of the states are states where they opened up earlier or didn't close down in the same way. So with less social distancing, they're getting more cases. I think we're going to see this kind of ebb and flow in different hotspots. It's not going to go away completely this summer. There'll be places where it increases. Certainly, that's going to be the case. It's not going to be completely gone. We are concerned that come October, when cold and flu season, the regular cold and flu season hits, we will then have the double whammy of cold and flu season plus COVID-19. Part of the concern is that the virus might have this seasonal component where it comes back in the colds, the colder seasons, like October, November, December, January, and it affects us, which might be part of the reason that we're seeing more of the virus down in Brazil, too, because, of course, it's their winter down there.
Yeah. And if it does come back in the fall, when the weather closes, gets colder, do you anticipate that it could be somewhat different? Is there a chance that it could mutate over the course of the intervening months?
Well, I think we're less concerned about mutation. We're more concerned about being prepared for this. This is the time where if we have, you know, certainly in places like California where we have decreasing cases, where we really need to be ramping up our capacity to deal with a really big return in October. So now is the time that we need to be doing that. Just like, you know, January and February, we should have been preparing as a nation for the onslaught in March. This summer is the time when we need to be preparing for the onslaught in October. We need to be getting our testing capacity up. We need to be getting our contact tracing capacity up. We, of course, need to maintain our hospital capacity and just get ready for this surge in October, which could be really bad.
Talking with UCLA's Dr. David Eisenman, we're at 866-893-KPECC. You can also ask a question via Twitter, tweet at AirTalk. You can post on the AirTalk Facebook page, or you can post on the AirTalk page on our website at kpecc.org. You're listening to AirTalk on 89.3 KPECC on the KPECC app, or when you're at home, use your smart speaker. Just tell it to play KPECC if you're out in the car and going to be at home shortly. Dr. Eisenman, also wonder about people being out in the world over the course of the three-day weekend. We had Eaton Canyon, the trail that went up to the falls there had to be closed, as well as the Nature Center, because there were so many people that came out to hike and to spend time that there was no way to distance. Many of the people didn't bring any face coverings whatsoever, despite the requirement that people cover their faces and give 6 feet distance between them. What do you think are the odds that these kinds of events like this will spur an increase in the spread?
Well, it's hard to say about isolated cases like Eaton Canyon. You know, my experience of the weekend was very different. I went hiking, and there were people, most people on the trail were wearing masks. When we got up to the top, people were socially distanced and wearing their masks. At the beach here in Venice, in Marina del Rey, where I live, people were by and large in small groups and by and large walking to the beach in mass. I think, you know, we didn't get the kinds of situations like we saw in the media, for instance, Lake of the Ozarks, where right now people who went to the parties there are now being told by local health authorities to quarantine. You know, I don't think we had those kinds of experiences.
That video looked like spring break, Dr. Eisenman. That was unbelievable, the partying going on there.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. And that's the kind of context where you can get real spread. And that's why the local health authorities have recommended anybody who went to that party to be quarantining. Those are those big events where there's a lot of people and you're very close to them. And, you know, all it takes is a couple people who are infectious to really spread it all around. That's what we need to be concerned about.
Dr. David Eisenman joining us on Air Talk. I was in Long Beach on Sunday, and as you described Venice and Marina Del Rey, it was very similar there. There were people passively using the beach out on a towel or, you know, just sunning themselves, but they were all separate group to group. In fact, way more than 6 feet between them. So it looked, to my eye, quite safe what people were doing, even though it wasn't strictly by the book active. But good to see that people were clearly taking the directive to keep their distance and to wear a face covering very seriously. Again, your questions for Dr. David Eisenman were at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Dr. Eisenman, I want to ask you about churches and synagogues and mosques being able to hold in-person services, starting with this weekend's services, no more than 100 or 25% of listed capacity, whichever is the smaller number. Your thoughts about the safety of gathering in that size of a crowd?
Well, there is risk, and this is why the new recommendations from the state suggest, first of all, that you hold services virtually if possible, because there is always risk in these kinds of gatherings. Some of the biggest outbreaks have occurred in church settings where people are closely packed for a couple of hours at a time. There's, of course, singing, which we know exhales a lot more virus than just talking quietly. So it is a concern. Luckily, these guidances do provide ways of opening up and some ways of mitigating the risk. Like you said, lowering the number of people to 25% of the capacity, reducing sharing of books and rugs and meals, reducing flow through high traffic areas like chapels, and all this, you know, if followed, can mitigate the risk. But it's definitely, and it's going to be all reviewed after a few weeks to see if this is causing any harm. But I think, to the extent possible, I, for one, who I enjoy going to services occasionally, would still rather do it virtually.
All right. And of course, the risk that comes from group singing, a huge issue, because for so many people, that's really central to the worship experience, is group singing. We're talking with Dr. David Eisenman, UCLA Professor of Medicine and Public Health. He directs UCLA's Center for Public Health and Disasters. We'll continue with more conversation on what we're learning about COVID-19 back in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, Dr. David Eisenman of UCLA joining us. One thing that's happening are that stores are opening up so that people can make their purchases. So many of the smaller retailers said it wasn't fair that the big box stores like Costco, Walmart, Target, that they were able to operate under conditions to try and keep people safer, but that the small ones weren't. They're going to get their opportunity. Now, as I recall, Dr. Eisenman, you're like me. You've sort of been locked down about even going to the grocery store, as I recall. I think your wife does the shopping, right? Have you ventured out into the store yet?
We do the shopping, but we do it individually. And we go as much as possible during off hours. When there's a long line, of course, I wait till another time to come and stand in line. We have practiced from the very beginning wearing a mask, washing our hands before we go in, washing our hands after we come out. I've been very heartened by how I see the grocery stores performing right now by limiting the number of people who are coming in, by washing down the carts before you get to use them and giving resources to that. So And people seem to be moving pretty quickly through the store. At least the ones I go to, people don't linger. They come and get their shopping done and leave.
All right. Good news. Let me share Ralph's comment or question. We hear much about possible timelines for a vaccine, but not other crucial aspects of the nature of this virus that are essential for knowing best how to live with it. What's a reasonable timeline for learning definitively whether or not contracting the virus will provide immunity going forward to those who contract it, or for whether or not the virus will become an endemic, much as herpes has?
These are really great questions. Both of those questions take time. So to know if people are going to be immune in a meaningful way means what we have to do is follow the people who have been infected already and developed antibodies, and then watch them through the next sort of wave of infections, which we think might come in October, and see if they are less likely to get the infection compared to people who don't have the antibody. So that just naturally takes time, and then also a lot of people, so that you have enough numbers to really detect the difference. Whether it becomes endemic is as much, we wait to see. It's probably unlikely that we'll ever get rid of this virus completely without a vaccine that gets into everybody. And we're talking about getting into everybody, you know, around the world. And that's a tall order in this political system where we aren't seeing global cooperation, where we're seeing partisanship around vaccine acceptance. And it has me worried. If people aren't willing to take the vaccine, there will still be people who will get the virus.
Norma says, I'm very disturbed by the reports of people dying at home from strokes and heart attacks, even refusing kidney transplants out of fear of being in a hospital and catching COVID-19. Have the public messages backfired? That's Norma's question.
It's been a real concern to all of us in medicine. We've seen a lot less patients, and we know that's not a good thing, which is why we're trying to really rapidly open up our hospitals and open up our clinics now and be very proactive in reaching out to our patients and calling them and asking them how they're doing. There's no doubt that there are people who died because they were afraid of going to the hospital. And the next step is to really make it very clear to people that they should come to our clinics, that they should come to our emergency rooms and come to our hospitals, that they can be safe. You know, our emergency rooms now have separate areas for COVID-19. Our hospitals have separate areas for COVID-19. We are testing people in the hospital to see if they have COVID-19 and have the coronavirus and don't know it. And if that's the case, we do all kinds of precautions so they don't infect others. And it's really important, if people feel sick at all, that they contact their doctor, because we can take care of them in a way that protects them at the same time from the virus.
Dr. Eisenman, it's always a pleasure. Thank you, sir, for being with us. We wish you and your family continued good health. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. David Eisenman is the director of UCLA Center for Public Health and Disasters. He's also professor of medicine and public health at UCLA, the Geffen School of Medicine, and associate natural scientist at the RAND Corporation as well. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC, the KPECC app, and your preferred smart speaker by telling it to play KPECC.